to the All About Symbian audio podcast. I'm Steve Litchfield, and I was at the Forum Oxford event this month, April 2007, where David Wood from Symbian was expanding on his vision for smartphones, Symbian, web browsing, and beyond.
So, nice to be in the Department for Continuing Education in Oxford. I confess I have actually presented here once before, 22 years ago, I think. In these days, we didn't have a PowerPoint, and it wasn't a presentation about smartphones, because there weren't many smartphones then either. It was actually on physics or quantum physics and philosophical implications of quantum physics, you know, Schrodinger's cat and spooky distance, action at the distance, all that kind of stuff. One reason I mention it is my colleague, my co-presenter that day, was a guy called David Deutsch, who talked about quantum computing. And since then, he's gone on to do a lot more about quantum computing, and it's going to revolutionize computing in due course, because there's more than two bits when you do quantums. You get more than two bits, more than two values. Anyway, I look forward to some stage in the next 22 years to talking about quantum smartphones and how they're going to revolutionize things. But the main thing I'm going to talk about is what's happening in the next 22 months, I think. How smartphones make mobile web 2.0 work, and that's really the answer to a question, which is, what is the ideal device to make mobile web 2.0 work best? We've heard a lot in the morning about some of the potential for mobile web 2.0. We've heard that there are challenges, and I am proposing a solution. And the solution is smartphones, and smartphones are phones, and they are also smart. And they bring a browser, but the main thing I've got to say is there's more to Web 2.0 than browsers. And so my sub-theme is browsers and beyond. And I'll try to squeeze in a few things on this bonus question, which is, well, it's still not certain, but what action should we take to make this future more secure? Web 1.0 versus Web 2.0. I'm an enthusiast and a believer in Web 2.0 just as much as I'm a believer in smartphones. There is a reality behind the hype. Certainly one aspect of the Web 1.0 and Web 2.0 is a great deal of excitement and probably overhype, and that's happened twice, and there's no doubt there will be a shakeout in the next year or so, just as was a shakeout in the past, hopefully not so painful. But behind that description, there is an underlying change, and over time, even though there's been companies failing and there's been stock prices going all over the place, there has been a continuing and steady improvement in the underlying capability of the web, and in part, that has been an improvement in the numbers and improvement in the revenues, and there's been also a qualitative change, whereas initially the web started off with only a few people contributing. And Web 2.0 has got many more people contributing and more easily contributing. So here I'm adopting a picture from Don Hinchcliffe. And it's a change from what you might call a read-only or a mostly read-only web to a wildly read-write web. A change, if you like, from a library to a conversation. A change from a centralized intelligence to a collective intelligence. And what excites me is the opportunity for this ever-growing collective intelligence to be accessed from a mobile device, and for the mobile device to be a first-class citizen of this collective intelligence. And what I mean is all these sites which have got user-contributed data to more or less extend, all the sites that we visit from our PCs are increasingly visited and accessed from mobile devices too. And it's already happening from early adopters. It's happening a lot from early adopters, as we saw in the Q&A this morning, when quite a few of us kept up our hands to answer the question, yes, I have visited the web on my mobile even today, and probably access some of these sites. So we early adopters are doing it. And it is growing for all kinds of reasons, which you heard. The bandwidth's improving, the screens are improving in all kinds of ways. The N95 has got an astonishingly clear screen. Handwriting recognition is improving step by step as well. Other intelligent things to anticipate what you might be writing in them. The predictable flat rate data charging is also step by step making this mobile access more widespread. Certainly, there's a lot to do with improvements to the web browsers, the improvements of Opera and Access, and more recently Nokia's Safari-based web browser are quite astonishing in what they can do and how they improve the experience. But all of that is still only in a way appealing to a small proportion of possible users. And it is my contention that there'll have to be a lot of improvements in the non-browser software before we really get the full potential of this up to its up to what it could be. And these will be dedicated native applications. So here's the picture. I'm talking about a device which can tap into this world and do all these things that's on there in a participative way, not just a receiving way. Tapping into the collective intelligence, I claim that a device that really lives up to this potential will do four things. First of all, because we want it to be in as many people's hands as possible, we want as many people to participate in this, it has got to be low cost, and it's got to be something that people want to carry with them anyway for alternative reasons, namely it's a phone, and this will bring about all kinds of benefits of scale, driving lower costs and in turn larger volumes, and so this will be based on a phone, but more than just a phone, it will play the rich, smart, varied digital content that's there, sound, rich text, video, web pages and so on, to live up to the potential of originating content as opposed to just receiving content. It will be an originator and editor of digital content too, and it will have to participate quickly so that it's not a slow, painful experience. It will have to be smart in the sense not just of intelligence, not just of fashionable, but smart in the sense of zippy and avoiding delays and jitter. So I claim that adds up to a mass market smartphone. And I've talked about smart content. What do I mean? Not just data, but data along with information about the data and metadata. So something about its history or about its attitude. Data that supports user customization and personalization, data that's responsive to user preference, it can be manipulated, edited, merged, mashed, and so on. That means, in fact, data along with code, or that can be associated with code to have this result. And that leads to my definition here of smartphone. Not only does it handle multiple types of data, including new types of data, but it can handle, in the spirit of user generation, it can handle multiple types of code to access, personalize, manipulate, and augment that data, including new kinds of code. And in the language of the motto of Nokia's S60, a smartphone is open to new features, whereas feature phones are fixed in the features they've got. And this is what will enable the creativity of the fixed web world to become equally present on the smartphones. And this goes beyond just what you can do in the browser itself. So here's the picture of the smartphone virtuous cycle, with the networks ever improving and more services is on them. There's the developers who can tap in and take advantage increasingly of the services available on the networks. What enables this is increasing volumes of advanced open programmable phones, in turn enabled by an open OS. To spin this picture a little bit more, it's not just the channels of the network operator, it's all the social networks that are being present on the wider networks and everything that can be done on top of that. And what enables this to really work is two words that's on here. One of these words is a word I've used rather a lot on this slide. You can see where it is. It's open, which basically means programmable, and it means that the applications that are written will fairly easily transport across to lots of the different devices. So interchangeable, open-minded, collaborative. The other key word that's on here that will make all this work is volumes. And what kind of volumes are we talking about? So historically, smartphones started off quite small. In 2002, we were singing the praises of having sold 2 million units in 1 year, and when we drew this chart in 2002, these lines were rather larger, as you can guess, because we never sold anything like 2 million units in a year when we were still PDA manufacturing, and this was a huge breakthrough. But things have kicked off since then. More than three times as many smartphones sold with Symbian OS in 2003, more than twice as many sold in 2004, more than twice as many sold again in 2005, and in 2006 we've now reached the stage, especially in the fourth quarter, of nearly two smartphones sold a second, more than 110 shipped cumulatively. That's just the start. That now comes to a lot of smartphones, but still, compared to the overall mobile phone usage, it's only about 5 or 6%. As it happens, it turns out to be the more expensive 5 or 6%. So if you're looking at revenues, I think Symbian phones are probably more than 10%, responsible for more than 10% of the revenues. And if you look at profits, possibly, and it's very hard to measure this, possibly up to 20% of the profits made on mobile phones are coming on Symbian devices. Just very briefly on the market as a whole, Symbian's market share has held up very strongly in the smartphone space, according to Canalys, more than 70%. Although there's a lot of talk about other operating systems gaining, you can see they're not actually gaining much. What's much more important is that the whole market is increasing. And that's what I want to briefly touch on. How is this market going to continue in size? And we have Moore's Law to help us. All the different facts, all the different aspects of the device are stage by stage getting cheaper. So the silicon that's in there gets cheaper. Other things get cheaper in different ways. When you put that on top of a projection of the overall sales of mobile phones, and this is quite an old projection, so it's a little bit conservative. I think we can do better than that nowadays. So these are all the phones, and how many of these will be available at the price of smartphones, and bearing in mind that price is coming down, you get something like this, which says that potentially by 2010 there might be 600 million of these sold in 1 year. Do I believe this projection? I think in some ways this actually underestimates it, and in some ways it potentially overestimates it. It underestimates it because of the networking effects, which can make the whole industry more and more profitable, and because of the learning effects that will kick in. I think the cost of a phone is not just the cost of the raw materials, of course, and as the raw materials come down, that helps, but as there are more and more companies working hard on this space, they will get cleverer and cleverer about manufacturing them more cheaply. So I think there is reasons to think that this could even be larger than this market. There are, of course, a very important reason why it might not be as large as that, and that reason is because something's technically possible in terms of this kind of calculation. Doesn't mean it will happen. To see this more vividly, let's look at another Moore's Law, not Gordon Moore's Law, but Geoffrey Moore's Law. And he long ago pointed out very correctly that many companies died because they thought, well, we've got the early adopters on board, they're excited, they're visionary, all we need to do is more of the same and we will stage by stage reach out to the rest of the market. No, no, no. In fact, there's a very big difference between the things that excite the early phase of the market, when people are interested in technology and feature, compared with the mass bulk of the larger market, where people are looking for complete solutions, reliability and convenience. The early adopters, of which most of us in this room make up, can accept bits of poor usability, don't mind a bit of debugging, don't mind occasionally rebooting, don't mind the phone being a bit slow occasionally because of all the stuff we get, whereas the mass market are not so interested in that poor usability, and they will be once bitten, 10 times shy from such an experience. And so to actually move forward in this and to get into that potential, we have to address, as several of the other speakers have said, the general issues of usability.
Just a quick question. Where do you see the N95 sitting on that curve right now?
N95 is a breakthrough device.
But where do you see it in terms of the perception? Because there have been, to be honest, some negative reports of usability and performance.
Well, I think it's a breakthrough device in all kinds of ways. It has lots of new technology in it. It's almost inevitable that some of that new technology will take some more time to debug. So I think the various Nokia is a past master at improving its devices stage by stage by stage, very systematically. I think that the first device will appeal to people mainly on the left-hand side of that chasm, but increasingly as the technology beds down, as the usability is improved even more than it is already, we will see this as a breakthrough device into the early majority. So I see this confluence of two megatrends. I believe that smartphones is very much on the up and up. I believe that Web 2.0 is increasing in importance as well. And I see three factors which make these two things bump into each other. There is the risk that I said at the beginning of lots of the Web 2.0 companies being shaken out. There are too many companies in there chasing the same eyeballs. That's healthy. That's the way the free market economy works. Many of these companies will say, right, well, they've got to do something a bit different, and they are interested in reaching users via new channels, gaining incremental eyeball time from people when they are mobile. They will eye up, of course, the ever-growing smartphone market size. 110 million plus now may reach a billion in a few years' time. And many analysts have underscored that prediction. The other thing that's going to help this is that there are many, many hungry, active, intelligent smartphone ecosystem players. That's companies who know how to program applications on smartphones very well. They have learned and honed these skills over the last few years as the first 100 plus smartphone models have come to the market, and they are now ready to join together and act and provide services to the Web 2.0 players. So this confluence is inevitable. It's going to lead to a transformation of smartphones and in turn a transformation of Web 2.0. There are many risks in this and there are many opportunities as well. And that's what I'm going to try and cover in the last 5 minutes or so. The actions that we can take to make this outcome better and therefore see this transformation live up to its potential as being an even more profound migration in some ways than the first move to the web. It's more profound because more people in due course will be tied up and there'll be quicker turnaround from people's ideas and appear on the web more quickly. So the first thing that we have to do is we've got to improve the browsers, and they are improving very dramatically, but there is something lacking in browsers which cannot, I think, really address some of the usability issues. And I think many applications are going to emerge which use web services and talk to the Web 2.0 sites and all the other information centers on the internet, but they will display it without using web browsing. And why? And it's because the web browser is a very general purpose application. It is done wonders, but it is often not the ideal device. It's not the ideal user interface, and especially given the constraints of these devices, it's more important that the user interface is optimized. And this one example, interestingly, on the PC is iTunes. iTunes talks to using web services to sites on the internet, but when you buy music using iTunes, you don't get a web browser inside iTunes. You get its own display, which is better tailored for the particular needs of what the user is doing. So it's when an application is sufficiently important and sufficiently different, for example, mobile banking, stock trading, consulting, travel itineraries, whatever, I am fairly sure there'll be many new mobile web apps which talk web services but don't use a browser to display themselves. So schematically they look like this. They suck up information from the web, but they display it well in whatever way is best for that particular data, rather than in a browser. And here's an example. It is one of the best-selling apps on Symbian smartphones and on other smartphones as well. It is an application that shows travel information, currency information, weather information, all got using web services of one sort or another and displayed in the UI that makes best sense. Another application, another example is Shozu, which is something that allows people to blog easily, talk to sites such as Flickr and so on. But it doesn't use a web browser to talk to Flickr. It uses its own dedicated UI, which has the benefits of a better UI and a faster speed and less data transferred during the uploads. That brings me to the second reason why we have to move beyond browsing, which is the question of dealing with intermittent connectivity, avoiding having to exchange data with the network all the time. So it's smart local caching. An example here is that although Google Mail is an interesting application and it's better when it's running as a dedicated application, it is not anything like as good an experience as standalone push email apps such as BlackBerry or many of the other push email apps, which work pretty well when you're not connected from the network. When you get a chance, you edit your mails, and whenever you've got a network connection again, the stuff silently moves up. So I expect many more applications doing the same kind of stuff, that they'll make a better job of intermittent connections to the network. So in conclusion, if we rush on here, four actions for making smartphones make mobile web 2.0 work best. Understand that mobile is different. Some of the things that are happening on the fixed web 2.0, some of the heavier uses of Ajax are not at all going to work well on the poor impoverished smartphones. Even though the smartphones are more and more powerful than they've ever been before, they are not going to be as powerful as the PCs, and lots of things that work well on the PC, as I say, have a miserable experience on the phone because of lack of attention to efficiency. and so on. So there are constraints, but also there are opportunities allowing people, as has been said, to take advantage of the location system and just being with you everywhere. We have to educate the industry about the benefits of smartness, moving beyond simple mobile email, for example, to smart mobile email, where you take advantage of the attachments, meetings, invites, and all kinds of other rich stuff that's embedded in your mail. Moving beyond SMS applications to stickier applications, where you don't use, doesn't have to remember how to, what is the number they're talking to in SMS. It's a much better UI when there's an actual application there. Addressing the problems of smart service creation and discovery, so that people can more readily find the applications that are guaranteed to work on their phones. There is some progress here, but I think there's a long way to go. People still aren't at all confident and about which applications they can reliably use. And last but not least, continually drive down the prices of these things, and so therefore the performance goes up. Keep the system open so that we will have high-value mobile web 2.0 for hundreds of billions of users worldwide, and indeed collective intelligence for all.